Hello, you're listening to the 10th episode of the Balcony podcast. I had a conversation with Canadian photographer Donald Weber. He's a photographer focusing on the effects of world power. And his latest book, War Sand, tells the perspective of war to the grain of sand. And I think that says something about the way he works. And what I appreciate is this, both really research approach towards what he does while also having a quite poetic perspective often. He created a series of newspaper format publications called the Information Front that contains images by Ukrainian photographers and photojournalists of the war in Ukraine, which I would really recommend to check out. I very much enjoyed this conversation. I hope you do as well, and thank you again for listening. Thank you so much for being up for this, even when being jet-lagged.
Yeah, well, let's see how it goes. I might start drifting off in about 30 minutes, you know, nodding off.
I see where that comes from.
Yeah, no, I'll be all right.
Yeah. Yeah, and the reason why I thought of you to have a conversation with is because I always appreciate, I know you from the teaching at the KBK, and of course I know your work, but what I noticed in you in the way of teaching is that you have a very kind of structured way of working and lay this very strong foundation for something, for, you know, the topic, why you make it, what you're working on, that feels quite solid and consistent, or that's what you seem to care about. But then the way, you know, you can photograph it, or how you're gonna photograph it, you seem very kind of fluid with that, which I always really appreciate. And I think that also comes back in your own work. In your own projects.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good analysis of things. Yeah, I mean, I guess I believe structure, well, that's an interesting word. I do wonder about the word structure, but maybe foundation. I think to me is very important. Like, what is it that I'm standing on? Or what is the thing in front of me? I always like to sort of conceive of it, say, as like a dining table. Anything can go on that dining table. You know, we can have all kinds of food, but we need to sort of put it onto something. So I don't necessarily know where or why and how that comes to be. But to me, it sort of actually opens up more, let's say, freedom of possibility to do the things that I would like to do. Therefore, once, say, the foundation is kind of, and not that it's set and then it's like a checkpoint and now I'm allowed to move on. It's sort of like a concurrent happening where I'm trying to think about what is it that I'm doing it? Why am I doing it? How do I want to do it? But in order to get there, I also have to be making. And I think in the making comes the sort of freedom and the flexibility. So you're not necessarily, say, tied to any one way of doing something. Which, frankly, I've often been told, you need to sort of have an assigned style or a way of doing, or like not necessarily like an expectation, but certain artists and photographers, you know, there is a certain manifest destiny of what the photograph is going to look like. So an expectation, let's say, from the outside. As were for me, I think because I like to sort of work within my structure, my foundation, I don't really know what the results are going to be. So today it could be something like that, and tomorrow it'll be something on the completely other side of things. So there's ups and downs to it, or let's say positives and negatives to it. But what I do like, though, is the I don't know when it's going to end and I don't know what's going to happen, but I kind of like that. And then eventually it sort of speaks to you. The work speaks to you. It says, okay, now we've sort of figured that out so we can go on to the next thing.
And how do you then relate to that when people seem to have that expectation or want to, you know, see you having a certain direction or style, or do you ever feel blocked from that?
I wouldn't say blocked, but there's sort of also a couple of ways of thinking about that. One is like the kind of the big ego way of doing something. You know, we all want to sort of be perceived to be successful within our world that we're operating in. Mm-hmm. And so therefore there are sort of like declared rules that one must follow. And if you're not necessarily, not to say I'm a rule breaker, it makes me sound like I'm a rogue agent or something, but mm-hmm. I just think like there are expectations that come from somewhere, who knows where they come from, but they are sort of like inherited legacies that you as an artist or as a photographer are expected to sort of operate within. And there can be freedom and flexibility within that. But then when you sort of say completely just work outside of those limits, and that's something that I'm more interested in right now with photography is like, what is well beyond, say, like the accepted norms? Like what is mm-hmm. sort of lying on the edge of Niagara Falls, you know, actually way down below on the edges? And I think partly because it has to do with I get bored very easily, so I don't necessarily want to be repeating myself. Mm-hmm. But it's also not a question, let's say, of like ejecting from the – okay, another way to sort of say it is like, well, if you keep changing from thing to thing to thing, you never actually really get good at something.
Yeah.
Which I think there is some truth involved in that. But in the same sense, I would say yes, but I'm perpetually practicing some kind of photography. I just don't really know what photography at any one time. But I'm still very much wedded to the idea of the, in a very traditional way, of the camera and light and exposure and a shutter that makes, let's say, an image. But what you can do with that, I think, is actually a very intriguing space to be in. So mm-hmm. it's kind of always building upon what you've done previously, but then also dismantling it and sort of trying to rebuild it into a completely different light to maybe perhaps achieve the sort of the same thing. Mm-hmm. But I also don't necessarily want to repeat. I like the idea of if I dismantle something and rebuild it, I'm never going to have the same thing. I'm going to have something slightly different. So that idea of like, what is that? Iteration. Right, like multiple. Mm-hmm. You keep building and building and building upon something, and yeah, who knows where it goes.
Yeah, yeah. So it's also about letting go of some control in there.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point, because I am a control freak, 100%, mm-hmm. which is probably why I like to have that, say, structure, as you call it, or the foundation, which gives me some kind of, like, rooted sensibility, which then is control, but then it's also nice to sort of I think, again, to be on the edge of like one's limits, mm-hmm. to not really know what it is that I want to know, I guess. I don't know. Maybe I'm also trying to be like 21 years old again, which I do kind of miss, because when you're mm-hmm. 21, there's sort of like, on the one hand, there's a naivete, but on the other hand, there's also like, yeah, I can do that. But also you haven't necessarily been like trained and disciplined into sort of thinking and doing in such a particular way. Mm-hmm. So if I can try to maybe perhaps subconsciously recapture what it means to sort of be semi, ignorant's not a right word, but unknown.
Yeah, yeah. Open.
Open.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, where are the possibilities? Where are the sort of, again, it kind of goes back to that, it's kind of a cliche, but those sort of edges or the fringes, the peripheries of something. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see to the horizon, but what is sort of beyond that horizon? Mm-hmm. And I think in that, like, liminal state between those two is, I think, a fun place to be as a mm-hmm. photographer.
Can you share a little bit more on how you create the fundament for your work and then how you build up from there?
I think that notion of foundation for me is one that's the one thing that can maybe drift across all of the various like individual pieces or projects of things that I've worked on, mm-hmm. As where the images themselves don't necessarily go from project to project to project. So that's why to me a foundation is a very important thing, because it kind of just asks at the fundamentals, like, what is it that I'm interested in? Why am I interested in something like that? And then for me, the kind of the how question, which is really about the approach that one takes to it, that can be sort of much more fluid and flexible depending on the situation at hand, or let's say the work at hand. And I think thinking about how, like, what is this thing going to look like? Like, should I be using this kind of camera? Should I be using that kind of camera? Like, what? So it's a question of technique to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. But that's also because you're kind of constantly making and reflecting upon the thing that's been made. So there you can sort of inject new things into it and go, oh, that was not interesting, or that was very interesting. Yet what I would say, and not to say that it's inflexible, but what sort of is the undercurrent or the thing that's there are sort of like the much bigger questions of what is it that I'm actually interested in? How is it that I want to approach the work?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that I'm, say, engaged in topic X? Those questions are also fluid, but I would say it's sort of like different conditions of time. To me, that's sort of like an almost geologic layer, right? Like mm-hmm. it takes a long time for those sort of questions to shift and change and operate. And of course, they're also responding to you in the immediate moment, but it doesn't necessarily change overnight, as opposed to when I'm actually in the middle of a photographic project, you know, making photographs out in the world, etc. Those things can change quite literally overnight.
Yeah.
So I like those sort of maybe the dualities between like that sort of, the geologic questions of what is it that I'm doing, but then also challenging that to a certain degree through the actual act of making. So the practice mm-hmm. of doing, so to mm-hmm. speak. And there is a nice tension, but also a balance between those two realms.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm making, it will always reposition or make me re-question, say, my more foundational questions that I'm asking myself.
We talked a little bit before on it that the question of who am I to make this work?
It's yes.
a question that I very strongly got in my exam. And in general, it's a question that students, I feel, mm-hmm. get asked a lot.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the question yourself? Like, is it a question that's very present in your
Well,
process?
I would say what's very present for me is the position that I take.
Yeah.
So it's about acknowledging who I am. That's why, again, that kind of goes back to like those foundational questions, right? Like, so a very simple one is like, who am I as a photographer? Where do I come from? What are the things that maybe have influenced me? What are the sort of experiences that I've had that have I've been able to accrue? And then how do you sort of say transform that into some kind of subjective work, so to speak? So I do think that question of like one's position, that to me is also a doorway in to be able to make certain work. So it doesn't mean that you speak for something, but you're speaking with something, you know, you're trying to engage with it from your perspective, from Hannah, from Dawn's perspective, etc.,
mm-hmm.
to sort of get to know something. But also for me, it's also like, you know, I lived and worked in Russia and Ukraine for a number of years. I don't have any attachment to that part of the world other than a simple fascination since I was 8 years old with
mm-hmm.
it. But it's my position that I take. And I hope that the work that I made there is not to say this is how it is, but this is how I understood it to be mm-hmm. from my point of view. So I think that's one aspect to think about, but also the sort of, let's say, position I think also comes with the situation of doing something.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, I really do believe in that sort of like accrued experiences, you know, as these sort of layers that you move through life, they sort of build upon you in a sort of subliminal way. And if you're in touch with, say, the sensitivities of who you are and what you are, you're able then to sort of piece all of those various layers and dots together into some kind of point of view, let's
mm-hmm.
say. And to me, I think a point of view is an important one to have, but that also comes along with a certain degree of like knowledge, self-awareness, responsibility, and those things. Then I think it kind of allows you to sort of move into, say, contested terrain, so to speak. I mean, I'm never going to speak for somebody, but I would definitely like to listen to and to participate in, and then maybe rework those experiences through my own subjectivity. Otherwise, I mean, I worked for a number of years as a journalist, as a photojournalist, and that always slightly bothered me because it was a detached sense of observation
mm-hmm.
and that I was supposed to be something that didn't have any lived experience or any, there was no position that I was coming from. I was coming from nowhere. And mm-hmm. that sort of was the obligation. And I always, that always slightly bothered me because I could be in a very bad mood that day and that's going to affect the kind of photograph that I'm going to make, or I could be really hungry and maybe all I'm going to be doing is taking pictures of food stalls and then somebody says, oh, this is only about food. So I don't know. I think that it's kind of an impossible position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, though, the flip side of that, though, for me personally, and this is a personal thing, so there's a bias here, is like when work becomes much too subjective. So it becomes just about me and whatever it is that I'm feeling and doing and saying at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like to kind of think about where do I come from and what are all of the experiences, affordances, et cetera, that I've had as a youth to a 50-year-old man. On the one hand, but then also I think being in the world is a very crucial thing. So I'm not just an isolated character, but I'm a part of a broader network of society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those two have to sort of come into balance. Mm-hmm. I think it's a tricky balance that one needs to find, but there is, I would say, an obligation or responsibility that we have to being in that world photographically, especially when we're making images, which become sort of a part of the representation of society. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah. I don't know. I mean, we will never be able to answer that question because I do see some great journalism is certainly coming out of Ukraine. It sort of has reignited my faith in photojournalism to sort of see these, not necessarily objective documents, but they're definitely pieces of a tragic moment in time right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that regardless of who photographed them, I don't need to know who photographed them, that they are sort of stand as records of some kind of catastrophe, let's say. So that's sort of more towards being the objective lens. But then I could think about, I don't know, like Elena Brotteris. I probably butchered her last name, but a Finnish photographer who photographed her own experiences, like the trouble with attaining motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, I believe she did have a child, but much of her work was a sort of about that relationship to wanting to be a mother and could not become a mother. So, and that's a very subjective, but, you know, both of those I think are super fascinating. But I think the point there is that there is a certain engagement, even in its most subjective, with not only how does this relate to me, but how does this relate to somebody else who might come into contact with mm-hmm. me, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Also, I can imagine that your position in it changes while you're in the process of making the project. I'm curious, you grew up in Canada and then at some point you moved to Ukraine?
Yeah.
And you probably, yeah, I mean, you grew up in Canada, you have some idea that you grew up with a story on Eastern Europe and then you move there and I can imagine that changes your own way of thinking, and it challenges your the stories you've had of East Europe.
Well, and I think actually maybe I don't know about now, but certainly for the first half or three quarters of my photographic career was all about defying those expectations or allowing the situation being in the world to sort of defy my own expectations and allowing those to sort of come together or to collide together, so to speak. Because, yeah, I did. I come from Canada. And for me, it's also very important. Like, whenever I do talk about my work, certainly my work in Ukraine and Russia, I always want to sort of foreground it with, like, why did this guy from Toronto end up in this place? And it wasn't random to a certain – it was semi-random, but it was also – I had an – to me, I had an obligation to go there. Mm-hmm. So I always like to talk about – you know, the year I was born, 1973, meaning if you move ahead 10 years later, it's 1983 and I'm 10 years old. And that to me was sort of when somebody starts to become aware of the world around them. And the way that I became aware of the world around them was through media. So through magazines, mm-hmm. through television news, through movies and pop culture. And of course, the biggest story at that time was the hottest part of the Cold War. So the Soviet Union versus the United States, good versus evil, et cetera, nuclear annihilation and all these kinds of things. So I grew up sort of digesting this perpetual image flow of mm-hmm. images from the Soviet Union, saying that, oh, this is our mortal enemy and they want to kill you and there's a nuclear war coming. And if it's not for the United States, then the world is all going to collapse. You know, these kinds of very elementary, I guess, arguments. But of course, as 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, you sort of believe it. And then, of course, I had my own history with Chernobyl when I was 12, 13 years old. I had pneumonia. It was 1986, and I heard it on the news. So again, I'm sort of digesting the world through media.
Yeah.
Quite literally media. So all kinds of images and pictures, but also through the radio and such. And so I think that I probably accumulated this history of a place that I'd never been to, but that's so present in my life. I mean, it might as well have been almost my next door neighbor or part of my family, you know? So for me, it was about wanting to go there and really trying to understand, well, just what is this place? So if Ronald Reagan says they're the great evil, then they must be. So let's go find out who the great evil is. So that kind of has always driven me. And I remember when I, not when I first started moving or traveling through Ukraine, which was in 2002, but I would say it was probably 2006 when I really started to understand the relationship between what I thought was real, so-called real, and what reality was through my eyes. And there's a great, fantastic book, and I'm not knocking it by any means, but by a former, or he recently died, I guess, a few years ago, Paul Fusco, Magnum photographer. And he was one of the first photographers or Western photographers to photograph the aftermath of Chernobyl. So we're talking in like 1987, 88 to 90, and he spent a lot of time there. But what he saw was very different than what I saw when I first traveled to Chernobyl in 2005. So almost 20 years after. The people that he was photographing, and these are sort of the images that have become sort of indelible in our brains about Chernobyl, is of an incredibly toxic environment, you know, mutants and deformations and terrible cancers and poisonings and deaths and such like that. It happened, but as somebody told me when I remember I first traveled to Ukraine, they said, yeah, but they're all dead. So this is what's here now. And that to me was kind of a shocking thing. And what I actually started to see there was a daily life. Like people move through catastrophe still, just as we somewhat do, so to speak. So yeah, I think that was for me a very important moment to kind of realize like the expectations of what I think, but then the reality in coming together and actually trying to get out of my own way, but still not refusing to completely like exit the picture because I don't think objectivity can exist, but allowing, I think, all of, let's say, that strange turmoil of growing up on a diet of news images, but then seeing the reality behind, say, those news images probably, I think, informed the kinds of photographs that I was seeking. So I was more interested in, for example, mothers and sons. I don't know why, but I really wanted to take pictures of mothers with their sons. I was very much interested in just the kind of almost banal landscapes of Chernobyl, because when you think of Chernobyl, it's Pripyat with, you know, destruction and such. But it's a vast area, and it's actually quite agricultural and forestry. So kind of moving through those spaces and such like that. So in that sense, it's, I guess, allowing those different narratives to be woven together. And I still think, even though I probably moved away from that, that that probably is what informs my choices today. It's having those previous experiences, but then also very much putting myself into the situation or the place at hand and allowing place to actually speak to somebody.
Yeah, and I feel that's the then also relating to the previous question of who are you to make this, you know, like it builds the bridge also. And if we completely stop from making work about anything that's quite foreign or something out of us, if we are, let's say, not allowed to make that work, then all curiosity stops.
I think you have to allow the traces of yourself to be present at all times. And I think it's also very difficult realm. Not everybody wants to necessarily be. I mean, I've noticed that in teaching, not everybody wants to sort of be confronted with, you know, who they are. Not to say that you have to, you know, lie down and talk to Freud or anything like that, but you do have to have, I think it's more a question of self-awareness and the kind of knowledge, like when you make a photograph, it participates in the broader world. It's helping to shape the world, and you can shape it for good, you can shape it for bad, or you can shape it for indifference, but it does participate. So it operates.
Yeah.
And you have to be aware of that. That's why I think at least maybe not, well, even today I could say it's still a part of that, but certainly the bulk of the photographic work that I have done has always, I've not made it about me, but I've allowed my contact with the origin of that story or that work to be present in it.
Mm-hmm.
So people are aware that I am a participant and maybe even an unreliable narrator within that story,
mm-hmm.
because it's only my experience.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe through the people around me, or maybe even if I have experts, it can only ever be filtered through my sort of interpretation. But in the same sense, I don't think it's about me per se.
Yeah.
And that, I think there's a bit of a fine line between that. I don't ever want to necessarily talk about myself, but I reveal certain things that maybe have intrigued me, or the positives, but also the negatives of trying to figure something out.
Yeah.
So through that act of interpretation.
I wonder if that's also in general maybe changing in these times, that I have to think of my mom. She recently said, because my parents work in healthcare, and she said that she is seeing this change, that back in the days when she was studying, doctors were recommended to never put any of their own emotions, you know, in a conversation.
Yeah.
So when
you
a
have
doctor,
cancer.
You, yeah, dot, yeah,
yeah,
end of the story.
Yeah.
And that it's now more allowed, or there's more freedom or looseness also in the academic world.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's just the same in journalism, where we may be moving away from a very, you know, that, oh, it has to be neutral, it has to be blanco. Maybe we're starting to accept more that we're all coming from some background. We're all colored in something.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I mean, I, for me, it's just like have a basic level of humanity and empathy.
Yeah.
Which just means trying to understand the situation that you're in, that you're not there to say this is exactly what's happening, but this is a situation that I am not necessarily participating in, because I don't think most photojournalists are participating in something, but they are a part of it. So there's a little bit of difference there. But also, I think, though, the problem sometimes, and it can also swing the other way, where if everything becomes, well, this is my knowledge of something, then there is no, like, grounded knowledge. So where is that, say, getting into dangerous territory now, but like that modicum of truth, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely sense, certainly within journalism, or at least people becoming more aware that whatever is being reported or is whatever is being photographed isn't necessarily the gospel, but it accumulates with all of the other, say, photographs that have coming from that, say, news event, to work together, to sort of operatively work together to create a sort of sensibility of what's happening or what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
At best, I think. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a tough one, because then there are certainly in the United States and parts of Europe and Canada where there's journalism with agendas. Fox News, for example, it's sort of painted under a picture of not necessarily of objectivity, but sort of like taking a degree of truth and making it into your own.
Yeah.
And therefore that truth becomes the realness. So
yeah.
I also think, you know, so where is that sort of like line between being so-called detached observer, where your picture like enters the world and you're like, yeah, it's not my problem. It's a photograph, to manipulation.
Yeah.
Because you're sort of subscribing or creating, let's say, a certain kind of agenda that then therefore your photograph or whatever it is, your news report or your journalism can sort of fit to that.
Yeah.
So there is sort of like a politics at play here that we have to be sort of, I think, aware of. But again, it just comes back to like the self-awareness of the individual within the scenario and the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would always think if I could go back in time, I'd probably want to study like political economy, to sort of, you know, you like when I was a freelance photographer, I worked for a multinational news corporation. So mm-hmm. who owns these multinational mm-hmm. corporations? Mm-hmm. The way that pictures sit within a newspaper or magazine are commodities. You know, they're beside advertisements. There's whole questions of circulation and distribution, like all of these kinds of things, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of, it's a way of understanding yourself as a photographer within a much broader relational network of other things that are happening. And so you can easily be, let's say, exploited, but it also means if you're aware of it, you can actually maybe not necessarily resist, but operate within it with an understanding of how these things sort of function. Mm-hmm. And when I was first starting out in photojournalism, I always took it very seriously that, well, but this is it. Like, but the picture is sort of out of context. So there's a context of where that picture happened, but it doesn't matter that I work for a multi-million or a multi-billion dollar corporation, mm. Et cetera, or it doesn't mean anything that, you know, going to a place that you've never really been before and you're sort of relying on a very particular network of sources and such to sort of tell you or to bring you to certain locations and places and such. So for me, that kind of, and this is, yeah, I guess, I don't know, it's for, well, most political scientists or economists are going to be like, yeah, duh, like this is reality. But for me as a photographer, I think thinking of, again, like the position that I take within the broader spider web of all of the various sort of things that are going on, even like the, let's say, the ecological construction of the camera today, mm-hmm. you know, to be able to think about in an analog day, all of the chemicals and metals and manufacturing processes that go into that camera. And now I go to, I don't know, the Congo on a story for UNICEF about some kind of mining catastrophe, yet I'm not able to sort of reconcile my own contributions to that actual mining production, I think, is sort of unfathomable. Mm-hmm. But again, not that everybody has to have this sort of expert knowledge, because I'm far from it. But it's just sort of, I think, again, having the understanding of where I'm sitting within something and all the various forces that are sort of passing through me.
Yeah.
And you just have to be able to sort of open your eyes to it and acknowledge it and then process it in some kind of capacity.
Yeah. And it has so many layers, you know, behind then something. And that's where you need to dig into things to get to understand what is behind that.
Yeah. And then, of course, then you could say, but then things are infinite and you'll never actually get to anything, yeah. which is, I guess, partly true. But that's why I do think thinking in, say, a relational way, like something is connected to something, just allows you to sort of like, well, what is my network? Like, mm-hmm. who and how am I situated in a particular network? What are the influences that I've become attached to? And what are the influences that I might then say project or things like that? Or hopefully it might mean, well, what kind of photographer do I want to be? Mm-hmm. Like, how do I want to exist? What is it that I can do? And again, just because our digital cameras are made of, you know, with tantalum and coltan, et cetera, which are precious metals that actually do come from conflicted places, doesn't mean that we can never take a photograph again. Yeah. But I do think we have to be aware of, let's say, the processes or the systems that influence that making.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's also some line between knowing it, but you cannot stop, you know, like if we actually react on everything that we know, like we know we're polluting things all the time, we can better stop existing
exactly.
with everything, right? So it's about knowing it and not avoiding that and not getting
like
afraid for confrontations in there, like knowing mm-hmm. where things come from and then reacting on it in a sensitive way.
Yeah. And that's the great power, I think, of being a photographer or an artist or whatever it is that you, the act of making in itself is also a great way to sort of understand these things, right? So you kind of can pull these various things and through the act of making, I think, is also, it is a subjective thing because you're the one that's actually assembling all of these various materials, whatever, into some kind of a photographic result. So it's not necessarily just the intellectual. In fact, I try to suppress that because I think at times it can overwhelm. But if you allow that sort of, I don't know, what is it, the primordial sense of making and doing to to kind of take things. It's just, to me, then it becomes a different way of understanding or processing.
Mm-hmm.
But at least my hands and my brain are trying to have some kind of relationship between each other. And then you can start to probably make some choices, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a great, there's probably a New Yorker cartoon, or it's a meme or something like that. And it's like some guy holding up an iPhone or some guy's pointing at somebody with an iPhone and says, aha, so you use an iPhone as well, you know, sort of scratching his chin as if he sort of caught you in a great quandary. Like, I can say, I don't like electronic pollution, but I might be typing it on my iPhone. Ah, but yeah, use an iPhone. So what am I supposed to do? Just nothing?
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah, I do use an iPhone, but let's now sort of figure out what those, I don't know, histories or trajectories of that iPhone is. Like, what can I do then?
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I've always kind of been interested in as well lately is like the notion of the amateur. Like, I don't really know something, but I have a love for something. I'm engaged by something. It moves me. It intrigues me. And I just want to be a part of it. I don't necessarily even need to do it for a living, but I think amateurs can make a living off of it. But the sort of amateur notion is sort of sidestepping expertise or professionalism, because I think also expertise and professionalism has somewhat led us down a wrong pathway, so to speak, which is about what we were talking about earlier, about like those inherited legacies and histories. Like, you become trained to do something.
Yeah.
This is how it's done.
Yeah.
Because that's what an expert or a professional does. But the amateur, I think, is there's a lot more freedom and flexibility in how one does it. Because it goes back to that sort of relationship to the self that you have with something. Like, I love this.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't have to do it because you have to perform for someone.
Yeah.
When you're an amateur, you do it because you love it. And when you do it because you love it, it's automatically in line with what you really care about. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it. And then you become good in it, or you start to train for it, and you start to study it. And then some maybe financial pressures come, and then all those layers can blur out a little bit.
Yeah.
Why you actually do it.
Why are you actually, like, why do you do this? I think about that with photography, of course, with photography students as I teach, is like, so what are you here for?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody, I think, at least 99% of the students that I've come across, just like I did when I first started, is like, somehow a camera came into my hands and I loved it. I don't know what it was about it, but there was something about that camera and looking through the viewfinder, and for my case, being in the darkroom and such, like, there's a real pleasure.
Yeah.
There's a joy in that. And one thing I always really made me feel sad, and I hope I probably contributed to that sadness, but I hope not. But it's like some students would say, but I've lost my joy. Like, after 1 or 2 years of their studies, like, I don't feel the same way about photography anymore as I once did when I was 15 or something.
Mm.
And I think part of that has to do is because we are training you to become an expert or a professional.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think some of that has to do with the fact, well, okay, let's dig into this a little bit more. And maybe that's also the flip side of the amateur, is like the unwillingness to sort of do the dirty work, or do the laundry, so to speak, of what it really takes to sort of understand like a photographic process, let's say. But yeah, I don't know. That's sort of like a strange space that I kind of like. But to me, I like that sense of the amateur. And I still think you can be a professional, but you have to sort of approach it from the lens, or through the lens of being an amateur. Like, as you said, you get into it, you learn it, you feel it, you feel like, oh yeah, I want to know more.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all coming from your own obligation to yourself to really want to dig into it. And as you dig into it, you become better at it, you become more learned. And then it kind of can turn into something. But I think if you sort of maybe go through that phase, or that way of making and doing and experiencing, then maybe that, although there's lots of moments where I've also felt like, oh, this sucks. I hate this all the time. But that's also, again, why I kind of want to reframe myself as like, okay, I'm an amateur here.
Yeah.
Like, that's ultimately what I'm doing, without any, say, expectations of how to perform.
Mm-hmm.
So before you're asking, I think about, like those obligations. And I always felt really bad when I would go to Perpignan or to Arles and Perifoto, all these sort of fancy places, and all my friends and colleagues be running around with meetings and such. I'm like, I don't have enough meetings. I got to go meet somebody. I got to be working on something. But certainly as I got older, as I started teaching, granted I had a salary, so there was certain less pressures that I could sort of choose out of my financial security to sort of put aside. But going to those places, just from an enthusiast perspective, suddenly actually recharged me to think, okay, what is it that I actually like about photography? Mm-hmm. What is it? How would I like to participate as a professional mm-hmm. in this world? Do I need to do this or do I need to do that? Mm-hmm. And yeah, as I said, granted, I do have financial security as a salaried employee of a university, but I also think anybody can sort of attain that if you sort of shift it back into that. And like, go to the next time you go to Arles, like approach it from the amateur's perspective, maybe even from the student's perspective. I used to love seeing the first year students at Arles because they would be like, oh yeah, we went to see this and we went over here and we did that. And we did this, we did that. There's sort of like, there's like a love and a joyousness. And of course there's pressure that sort of mingling in the air that you can't necessarily avoid. But the question is, how can you sort of not avoid it, but like, what is it like, and not suppress it because eventually it'll come back to bite you, but like mingle with it without mm-hmm. it like dictating your necessity to be or to do something in an image that isn't necessarily reflective of who you are at that moment.
Yeah, and it's about also sometimes just like taking a little bit just time to let it be, and then things come by itself. I feel that sometimes, and I don't know if that's just the really like productive, fast times we live in, but you know, it's like it does feel, things do feel like a rat race. I've been sometimes surprised also in KBK, the normalization of this rat race mm-hmm. and to always push things a lot. And sometimes I feel like that's not really the way to get somewhere, like to just take a step back and breathe a little bit, then actually things come.
Yeah, you have time. Yeah, that's also, I'm also, yeah, I think you make a good point. Like the normalization at it within an educational environment is like, well, what are we ultimately doing? And of course, there's all these other big discussions, certainly in the United States, where they're closing all like the history and English and humanities departments because they're not producing jobs.
Mm.
So at what point are we educating or are we training? To me, I think there's a big difference between those two things. And it's difficult, especially when you're young, because there's, even when you're old, let's say young in terms of starting something, because I was 28 when I started photography. I know lots of people who are in their 40s, even in their 50s and such, who are just sort of young at photography. But you want everything immediately, which I also understand. But then there are also these pressures in order to achieve whatever it is that you want. There's like a weird rule book that's floating around. I would love to know who wrote that rule book because nobody seems to sort of really understand it, but we all sort of enforce it. And for me, again, it's sort of, I've had the luxury of sort of working my ass off for the first 10 years of my career to like thought doing everything that I thought I needed to be done, but then at one point sort of also realizing, oh, wait a second, like, again, it goes back to that notion of the amateur. Like, I sort of lost sense of why it is that I'm doing this in the first place, which is part of the reason why I ended up going into teaching, is to sort of kind of like position myself within like that reflexive space. And that's what I like about teaching, is to talk with students about like, yeah, but what is that you're doing? You know, I like those sort of questions and how can we get there? But yeah, the point I think also being is like, how does one operate within an environment that has certain layers of expectation and capitulate to those expectations and in the same sense still maintain something that's yours and not necessarily, as you say, succumb to the sort of rat race of performance metrics, which yeah. I think are all too, even I would say they're probably at its worst right now with social media and such like that. But how does one sort of be a photographer that's kind of, again, I think about the peripheral actions. Because peripheral means you're aware, but you're not necessarily steeped in something. Mm-hmm. So you're able to sort of look to your left and I say, oh, okay, this is whatever. And I can look to my right and there's sort of the unknown. And that to me is kind of an enticing position, I think, to be within. But of course, it takes a long time, especially in photography, where it's really about your name as well. So mm-hmm. I, Hannah Burgers, or I, Donald Weber, it's like me as the author, as the artist is so sort of, and I think we sort of lost sense of that. And mm-hmm. one thing that I'm very interested in right now is the sort of like, thinking about, can I de-author myself completely out of my own work? So if somebody ever mm-hmm. sees the photographs that I make, they have no clue who makes that, mm-hmm. which it's probably more of a thought experiment, but I am sort of thinking actively through that notion. And the reason I think about that is because I do wonder, especially with photography, which I believe, or not I believe, I should say, like, what I'm intrigued by the potentials of photography is when it's like a mass communication medium. And so it's not necessarily about authorship per se. Mm-hmm. And authorship is also then very much the singular voice that sort of says something. I mm-hmm. say this. And if you sort of, I don't know, de-author oneself out of existence in a way, it's also perhaps, I don't know, I'm still trying to figure it out. Less of those, let's say, legacy expectations that are placed upon you. And I'm talking again from a very particular point of view. Let's say from like the fine art photography world kind of thing. And with fine art, I'll also throw parts of photojournalism into that and parts of, say, documentary and parts of some other things. But that sort of photographic realm where we are all considered as individual makers. Mm-hmm. I'm a part of that, you're a part of that, etc. I teach in that environment. But then there are infinite amounts of other modes of photography that to me is kind of an interesting one, which means, I think, you know, historically, national park photographers in the United States whose job was to photograph Yosemite, but at the same time to photograph the new toilets that they just manufactured or the parking lots, you know, these kinds of things that aren't necessarily, traces of some kind of individual artistic sensibility or like an act of expression, but rather acts of like evidence or mm-hmm. record or of document or of even banality in a way, like most of social media photographs are just sort of like, there it is. And we move on to the next thing. But that's a whole other discussion. But I don't know. I just think it's perhaps, again, it also goes back to the amateur because most people don't know who the amateurs are. And there's a great thing about like folk art, which I find fascinating. There's like the Museum of Modern Art, but then there's the Folk Art Museum. And the Folk Art Museum will never be, maybe occasionally on the very rare occasion will, like a folk artist end up in the Museum of Modern Art. But they have very different sort of exclusivities sort of behind them. And I can sort of put exclusivity alongside professionalism and training as where amateur to me is, again, I'm doing it because I'm just sort of engaged and I do it. And I don't necessarily, not that I'm ignorant, but it's just like, I don't care about, say, those that unauthored rule book that everybody talks about is not necessarily something that I'm so interested in.
Yeah. And it also comes back to what you said in the beginning where, you know, if you build a brand around your own name or you become a specific author, that puts a pressure of, oh, Donald Weber is known for this and this, in a way stops your freedom.
Yeah, I think the great thing about photography is that it's a constantly expanding medium. So why not participate in sort of, what about this? What about this? Yet in the same sense, there's a couple of great photographers who I absolutely love who have been doing it, their sort of way of seeing for 40, 30, 50 years. Mm-hmm. And I love it. And it's not to say that they're stagnant or not changing. Like Harry, I can never pronounce his last name, but as a Dutch person, you can correct me. Kruijert, the Belgian Harry
Grauert.
Grauert?
I don't even know.
Harry? You should look him up. Harry Grauert.
Harry Grauert.
From Belgium. He's a Magnum photographer. Absolutely mm-hmm. beautiful color and light and amazing sort of sense of composition and such. But you really get the sense that he's perfecting that one photograph. And,
yeah.
And that I can sort of admire. Yet in the same sense for me, though, personally, what I like is to sort of dwell within a realm of something and being competent at it, maybe not even being an expert, being competent at it. But then, I guess for me, it's the way that I always like to think about it is like, the story determines its own execution. So it speaks to me. It says, we should really think about me being depicted like X. I don't know how that comes about, but that's the way it goes. So for me, it's that sort of notion of what is it that I'm trying to say comes first. And then the visual strategy or the execution sort of comes through those queries and experiments and playful gestures where I go, yeah, that seems about right. Yeah, that makes sense. And then I stick with that for a little bit for that work. Even now with the latest project, it's not always an intentional thing. That's something I was reflecting about recently, sort of looking back at all of my various projects. It's like, pretty much each work is kind of semi-distinct. And I'm not saying I'm going from one dramatic thing to another thing, but there's definitely, let's say, appearances that shift on a consistent basis through each of my individual works. And a lot of it I think it's also a subconscious thing. So I don't ever say, I need to do something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that once and I actively forced myself to not photograph in the way that I had previously been photographing, but that was for other sort of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But I think partly because going back to that question of the foundations, it's like, what am I interested in? How do I want to tell this story? Why am I interested in this work? And I think through those sort of foundational questions, the sort of, let's say, the results or the image comes through. Not just the intellectual sort of thinking, oh, what am I doing? But the kind of making of.
Mm-hmm.
And just now I'm working on something and I didn't intentionally set out to do something in a completely different light, but it just, again, it sort of through the act of making it and doing it, it naturally sort of, maybe not naturally, but it evolved
mm-hmm.
to be something that I'd never even thought of that I would do before.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I think that's why I like to think in those foundational moments, because that act of making is where the transformation comes out, and it will always constantly surprise you. And for me, as I said before, somebody who gets bored very easily and needs to, or the grass is always, oh, it's better over there, I think it's a good way of working, because then you're always sort of like perpetually within a new territory or space.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, frankly, it probably has hurt my career, my capital C career. But I also like to be a little bit of a, what do you call it, a contrarian. It's like, no, I don't need you. Even though, I would love to have certain things. But no, but I think it's like, but then in the same way, because I've been so consistently inconsistent, I've become consistent, you know?
Yeah.
So I think people do kind of, oh yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which is also something, but I don't know, like, I really kind of at times feel like I would like to always be 12 years old to a certain degree, because there's a great like capacity to not really not care, because I care about things, but like a great capacity to perpetually like live in like wonder and curiosity.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
to sort of want to know, well, what's this? What's this? Yeah. And you stick your finger in the electrical socket.
Yeah.
But now I've done that and I don't want to stick my finger in the electrical socket because it hurts.
Yeah.
But in some sense, I do miss that. I want to get zapped every now and then. And I think that's also why I like to sort of maybe destabilize my own practice always perpetually to never sort of let it sort of become sediment, you know, to settle.
Feels like a natural state, right? Like as a kid, you're in this natural state. Mm. You're not in all these layers of, it doesn't get too much in the head.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just in the moment, in the body, that's what you are as a kid. And yep. The more, yeah, also it's like the intellectual layers and all this on top, it can push you back.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, it's like, yeah, I think the immediacy of probably, you know, of childhood and is like, oh, like impulsive. Maybe that's a way. Of course, impulsive can slide too far. You put your finger into the socket. But yeah, there is an impulsiveness like to draw you into something. Yeah. Okay, let's find out. Like, what does that mean? What is this? Who's that? Yeah. Hence all those questions that, you know, when you're the toddler, well, why? I like that being. And I've certainly noticed, I just turned 50 like 2 months ago and not even 2 months ago. And I'm like, no, I don't ever feel old, but I definitely think back, let's say the last 25, 27 years since I was like in my early 20s. And like, yeah, of course, lots of things have happened in my life where it sort of slows you down a little bit and makes you more cautious. And yes, I would like to have a salary. And yes, I want to have security, you know, all of these kinds of things, which I can appreciate. And I also like the idea, like I'll always say to anybody who's afraid of turning 40, for me, the 40s were the best decade of my life. Absolutely. If I could just be in my 40s for the rest of my life, I would take it. Because there's a certain degree of like knowledge and wisdom and experience, and you become good at something.
Mm-hmm.
I really like being good at something, not in an arrogant way, but in a way that gives you confidence. And yet with all of that, I think we also lose something, which is the unknowability of something. So how can I sort of allow that to happen? And frankly, I do think, again, with this next project, is like it's taking me into a territory that I look at it now and I think, I think it's kind of ugly and stupid and nobody's going to react to it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also okay with that because at least it's sort of, you know, like I'm 12 again, into an unknown territory.
So having that skill of being able to adapt, I think it's also just helpful outside photography. We are exposed to such a fast pace of change that we need to learn how to be with that in general.
Yeah.
Be with change and be flexible because we're not, you know, where back in the days you had a job, what your father did and your grandfather did. Yeah. And you just take over that. Like that's just, there's so much structure gone.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's also what I always think about. Like, whenever I read these enraging articles this summer of like, oh, we're closing down the history of the English, blah, blah, blah. It's not about jobs. You've got to create jobs. I just get enraged about that. It's like, but I still think somebody can study photography and never, ever, ever pick up a camera again. And I think they have a great education if they go
and
to.
And we don't know in 5 years what those jobs are going to be anyways. Well, because,
exactly. And why is it that only we're ever training for a job?
Yeah.
What about to be like a human and to have some kind of like, I don't know, responsibility and humanity and being able to, I don't know, creatively navigate through life rather than being disciplined as a
machine.
As a machine into some kind of whatever. I don't want to belittle those who choose business or something to study. But yeah, I think it's just well, probably what, I don't know, studying photography or any kind of art education or history or English or something, humanities, there's a certain degree of like flexibility and freedom and creativity that comes with sort of adequately intellectually knowing, but then having the capacity to sort of make and to practice.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I certainly always try to, with myself and with students, is like, okay, you can talk about that, but let's... Why don't you
put it out
there, like transform it into something? Like how does that sort of knowledge transform itself into experience, let's say?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah.
Photography.
Thank you.
It's good to chat.
Good to chat.